This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Evan Wasuka, and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia, where we'll look at the top stories from around the region. Coming up on the show, questions over Pacific workers' rights, as one seasonal worker threatens to sue his Australian employers over a workplace injury. Vanuatu imposes a ban on the killing of bats and native birds following multiple cyclones. And MPs in Fiji welcome the return of Fijian and Hindi languages to Parliament. But first, Australia's National Rugby League could soon include a new Pacific team. NRL officials are in discussions about adding three new sides to the tournament. A Pacific team based in Cairns is tipped as the leading contender. But what would it mean to Papua New Guinea's own bid? Marion Farr with more.
Samoan Rugby League player Ernest Suavai would love to see a Pacific team based in his hometown.
I think it's a great idea. The Pacific Island community up here is strong.
The 31-year-old lives in the far north Queensland city of Cairns, which is tipped as one of the possible locations for a Pacifica NRL team.
We have a large number of Cook Islanders, Samoans, Fijians and Tongans, so you know, the idea of a Pacific Islander team being based here in Cairns would be really good.
It's an idea that's gaining heat as Australian Rugby League officials reveal they're in serious talks about expanding the tournament. Speaking with Australian news company News Corp, ARLC chairman Peter Vallandis said he was all for adding three new teams to the comp. It would be a major shake-up for the NRL, and a Pacific team is tipped as the front-runner to win a licence. Ernest Suavai says if the team was based in Cairns, they'd be showered in community support.
I guess our community can get real intimate and help out and with the Pacific Islander team.
He got a taste of that 2 years ago when a Cook Island team played in North Queensland.
Just a showing of love that the community gave to us just through those games there. The support we got was phenomenal. It was just outstanding. And the supporters were singing cultural Pacific Islander songs while you were playing. And, you know, that just gives a different buzz when you're playing on the field.
Cook Islands Rugby League President Charles Carlson is also on board.
Queensland is the place to be based because that's where the population is.
Mr. Carlson is also a director of the Asia Pacific Rugby League Confederation. He says having a Pacific NRL team would create more pathways for the region's talent.
This will provide another opportunity for our Pacific players to aim for.
While support for the idea is strong, the big question is who will bankroll a Pacific NRL venture? Talks of Australian government funding have circulated in the media, but nothing concrete has been put on the table. Instead, the team could find its fortune in the North Sydney Bears. The cashed-up club says it's willing to finance a Pacific side as part of its bid to get back into the NRL. The Bears exited the comp in 1999, but board member Billy Moore told ABC Grandstand they're desperate to return.
And we present a very, very adaptable model to the NRL. We're basically saying we've got very few non-negotiables. We want our colours back, our badge, minimum two games at North Sydney Oval, and we will fund the rest.
Cairns player Ernest Suavai thinks it could be the perfect solution.
If it's to help the Pacific Islander people get a team up and running, I back that 100%.
But the idea of having a Pacifica team based in Australia is not without controversy. It could quash Papua New Guinea's long-held aspiration of having a PNG-based team in the NRL. The ABC has approached the PNG RFL and the NRL for comment. So far, we haven't received a response. Ian Chow, president of the PNG rugby team, the Lay Snacks Tigers, says deciding where to base a Pacific team isn't a simple question.
Port Moresby would be better to be based there. They'll get like very big support in Moresby, but I think NRL, they look at the merchandising, you know, like TV rights, all that other stuff. So if he doesn't tick the boxes for them, they'll move it somewhere else.
He reckons there are some big misconceptions about the risk of having a team stationed in PNG's capital.
You know, when you go to a game, there could be violence, but that normally happens with intercity teams normally, but with any Aussie team, it will probably never happen because any foreign players, they all treated as gods of sport.
He also says there's been major improvements to PNG Airlines, allowing players and fans to travel between the countries reliably. But he does concede that getting a PNG-based side off the ground would be a big job.
I think we need some time to actually build on our infrastructure.
And he believes a PNG team would need to look beyond government funding.
If we're relying, putting our hands out to the government all the time to keep this team going, if someone's not happy in the government and withdraws funding, then the team's dead.
For him, partnering with the North Sydney Bears is a good way to go.
We get half the team as our team. That would be the best outcome for us instead of trying to do a sole Papua New Guinea one, because I always believe trying to do it on our own, it won't happen.
That said, Cairns also doesn't have the right infrastructure currently to host an NRL team, according to Ernest Suavai.
I mean, if we could get the right facilities, I think it'll be great. And I'm hearing talks of facilities being built, possibly being built.
With heated discussions happening behind closed doors, anything could happen. But for Mr. Suavai, hopes are still high. While he may have missed his chance to play for a Pacific team in Cairns, he knows a couple of up-and-comers who just might.
It's probably something for my two sons to look forward to.
Ernest Suavai ending that report by Marion Farr, with additional reporting by Kyle Evans. As the number of Pacific seasonal workers in Australia reaches record highs, questions are being raised around the rights of workers and health coverage. It comes as one Solomon Islands worker threatens to sue his Australian employers over injuries he suffered on the job. It's a complex issue, and as Liam Fox reports, it'll be a case closely watched by both workers and companies.
For Moses Tateora, the opportunity to come to Australia as a seasonal worker was the chance of a lifetime.
When I come here to Australia, I come here to make earn money, because, you know, in Solomon Island, there's a very low percentage of job for the unemployed like me. So it's a very struggle for me, and I got big plans back in Solomon.
But those plans were shattered after he was injured on a farm in North Queensland.
I get married last year. My wife back home don't understand me, what's happened to me here. So, yeah, now, you know, my wife divorced me because of my accident, and she don't understand what happened to me here.
In October last year, Mr. Tateora says he fell off the back of a slow-moving ute. He injured his back and spent 2 weeks in hospital with spinal shock, unable to feel or move his legs and feet. After his release, he says his employer, Labour Hire Agency Top of the Crop, tried to rush him back to work. Here's Mr. Tateora's lawyer, Gary Scott.
Not long after his injury, when he got out of hospital, before he was fully recovered, the employer was trying to force him back to work. He wasn't in a position to go back to work. His visa had subsequently been cancelled as well, so we're trying to organise things with immigration so that he can get back onto a seasonal worker visa so that he can start working again.
Mr. Tateora terminated his contract, which means he's not covered by workers' compensation insurance or health insurance. So Mr. Scott is pursuing a personal injury claim against his employer on his behalf.
I feel very frightened because we're Solomon Island workers. We come here, seasonal work here. We don't really understand our rights.
In a statement, Top of the Crop denied any poor treatment of Mr. Tateora. It said it was Mr. Tateora who was very keen to get back to work after his release from hospital, and he was not forced.
Mr. Tateora returned to light duties for 2 days, then revisited his treating practitioner, who performed a further thorough examination. Following that, Mr. Tateora provided us with a full medical clearance to return to his pre-injury duties. Despite this, and as an abundance of caution, we elected to retain him on light duties. Before Mr. Tateora could return to his pre-injury duties, his solicitor confirmed that he had resigned from his employment.
Top of the Crop said the incident was investigated by the government agency WorkSafe. That investigation has been closed and no prohibition notice was issued against the company. It said it was unaware of any current litigation against the company, but if pursued, it will be vigorously defended. Lawyer Gary Scott is also pursuing a separate personal injury claim for another Solomon Islander who fractured his wrists while working for another employer harvesting bananas on another Queensland farm last year. Mr. Scott has previously lived in Solomon Islands and speaks Solomon's Pidgin and says workers like Mr. Tateora need to be more educated about their rights in the event of a workplace injury.
If we hadn't met him and advised him of his rights, he may very well have been sent back to Solomon Islands, because we have heard, unfortunately, of some injured Solomon Islanders who were sent back to Solomon Islands without knowing their rights.
Pacific Beat has sought comment from the Department of Employment and Workplace Relations, which oversees the operation of the Pacific Labour Scheme.
Liam Fox reporting. And joining me now to go through some of the big stories in the Pacific this week is Priyanka Srinivasan, the host of Pacific Beat. Now, Priyanka, Fiji's Prime Minister Sitiveni Rabuka welcomed his Australian counterpart, Anthony Albanese. What happened during talks in Nandi?
Yes, that's right. Anthony Albanese made this a brief stop in Nandi last week to meet with Fijian officials. Now, the meeting came right after this landmark nuclear submarine announcement that the Australian Prime Minister made with the United States and the United Kingdom. Basically, it detailed Australia's massive AUKUS project. That's to develop and to host nuclear power submarines here in Australia. But there has been concern in the past, ever since this deal was announced, that it might fuel a regional arms race. There's been particular concern around the region. Of course, the Pacific is a nuclear weapons-free zone. There is this agreement, this treaty signed between Pacific leaders, including Fiji, including Australia. And there were some concerns about what this AUKUS nuclear submarine agreement means for that. But Mr. Rabuka has actually come out to support AUKUS. That happened after he met with Mr. Albanese. He told reporters who were travelling with Mr. Albanese in Fiji that he backed the deal, he backed AUKUS, and he was his concerns were put to rest by his chat with Mr. Albanese. And Australia is expected to continue to do this, to continue to assuage some of those concerns from Pacific leaders. In fact, we expect that Foreign Minister Penny Wong will be travelling the region to discuss AUKUS and discuss what the implications might mean for the Pacific.
Now, moving away from Fiji, last week the president of Micronesia made international headlines when he claimed in a letter that China was inciting political warfare in his country. This week, China responded. What did officials say?
Yeah, well, not much. They attempted to, or appear to attempt to defuse the situation. So just to give some background first, this has all started from this letter, as you mentioned, from Micronesian President David Panuelo. He did talk about political warfare in his country by China, as you said. This was all in this letter to Congress. He also called for ties to be severed with China in favor of Taiwan and accused China of espionage and bribery. I mean, some inflammatory remarks there, accusing Chinese diplomats of even following him, hounding him. China's foreign ministry spokeswoman has said slander and accusations against her country are inconsistent with the facts. And she also said that, however, that China respects Micronesia's development path. Let's hear a bit from China's spokeswoman Mao Ning now.
We noted relevant reports in which the smear and accusations against China are completely inconsistent with the facts. We will never accept that. I would like to stress that China always advocates that all countries, regardless of size, are all equal. We always respected Micronesia's development path that it chose in light of its own national conditions and supported the Micronesian side in safeguarding independence and promoting development.
So that's what China have said publicly, but do we know if President Panuelo's letter might have caused a stir otherwise?
Well, yes, there are expectations that it would have, particularly his remark about how far he's gone to sort of action the switch from recognizing China to Taiwan. In his letter, he has also claimed that he met with Taiwanese officials in February and asked for $50 million in exchange for his country recognizing Taiwan over Beijing. And he says in his letter that Taiwan agreed. So it's expected that will make quite a big stir, particularly because the area that Micronesia is in is quite politically fraught. It's a critical region. It's very close to the U.S. territory of Guam, and this whole region is expected to be a zone of potential combat if there was a confrontation between China and U.S., just geographically the where it is. So that means if Micronesia were to change allegiances, it could influence diplomacy in that area. Dr. Graham Smith, the associate professor at the Australian National University, made that very point. He said that such a move, switching diplomatic ties from China to Taiwan, if Micronesia was to do that, would be significant in the region, though it might not exactly have an impact on the ground for people in the Pacific. Let's take a look, listen to Dr. Smith now.
But where it is important is this matters. This is the core issue for China in the Pacific, and it's a huge, they will take it as a huge slap in the face because that is their number one concern. They see it as an issue of sovereignty, and they see a switch like this as a violation of their sovereignty, you know, even though it has little practical impact on the ground.
And that was Pacific Beat presenter Priyanka Srinivasan with some of the big stories from around the region. And it's not only people who are doing it tough after the destruction caused by twin cyclones. So too is the wildlife. So much so that the government has updated its emergency response to include a ban on the killing of native birds and bats. Liam Fox with more.
In a recent update to post-cyclone directives to government agencies, alongside issues such as the restoration of communications and the release of superannuation funds, was an order prohibiting the killing of native birds and fruit bats. The Environment Minister, Ralph Reganvanu, says the surprising directive came about after complaints from the public.
That there are a lot of kids going around with slingshots, shooting and killing these birds and bats because all the trees have been destroyed, the coverage has been destroyed, their food has been destroyed, so the birds and bats are coming very close to the ground to access food. They haven't got any shelter anymore.
Fruit bats are an important source of protein in some areas, but Mr. Reganvanu says that's not why people are killing them in the wake of cyclones Judy and Kevin.
The government is providing relief for people, and there's a lot of food still able to be consumed for the first week of after a cyclone. It's the food that's been blown down and so on. We expect normally after a cyclone, for about a week, people still have access to crops that haven't been spoiled yet. So wouldn't expect them to be hunting birds and bats for food at this stage.
He says the ban only applies to native birds and bats.
We will notice that we didn't refer to a famous bird we call, in the local language, we call it sako, which is a pest, and we are definitely not discouraging people from trying to kill them because we try to kill them anyway.
The move has been welcomed by conservationists and scientists like Tyrone Lavery from the Australian National University.
Anecdotally, we hear a lot about after cyclones, there's increased pressure on flying foxes and birds, flying foxes in particular, because a lot of the leaves lose their foliage and they become a lot more vulnerable to hunting, a lot more exposed. So I think in the short term, at least, it's a good measure.
Back in 2018, Dr. Lavery took part in a voyage through Vanuatu and Solomon Islands to find rare bats. He says there are three species in Vanuatu. Two are listed as vulnerable.
One of those is a Pacific flying fox that's really widespread and not known to be threatened at the moment. But the other two, the Vanuatu flying fox and the Banks flying fox, are vulnerable and endangered on our international list of threatened species. So they're ones that we're worried about.
The Banks flying fox is located only on the Banks Islands in Vanuatu's north. Thankfully, an area which was not hit hard by the twin cyclones. But Dr. Lavery says the species is an example of how vulnerable some native plants and animals can be to natural disasters.
Because they live in such a small part of the world and only on a few islands, a cyclone will affect basically the entire area where they live on the planet. So they're one species that we really need to think about following these two cyclones in Vanuatu.
Back to the ban itself, and Environment Minister Ralph Reganvanu says policing it will be tough amid the cyclone recovery effort, but hopefully community leaders will help enforce it.
I appeal to chiefs and community leaders to assist the government to do it at the community level, to try and address it with in the villages and communities. And so the order just is trying to give extra weight to any directives by community leaders to stop.
Vanuatu's Environment Minister, Ralph Reganvanu, ending that report from Liam Fox. In Fiji, MPs are celebrating a decision allowing them to speak languages other than English in Parliament. A controversial 2018 order banned the use of Fijian and Hindi in an effort by the Bainimarama government to remove ethnic differences and make Fiji more inclusive. But 4 years on, and that ban has been overturned, and as Letha Mavona reports, MPs are celebrating.
Alitia Mbainivalu wanted to send a message directly to the people of her home province. The newly elected Member of Parliament from Ra in the west of Vitilevu is one of the youngest MPs in Parliament and one of only four women. The 42-year-old says doing the address in her own Ra dialect would be a good way to mark the historic occasion.
Told the people of Ra that this is a new era for us. Yeah, this is a new page in probably a new chapter in a book that we've finally got someone from Ra. I'm here in government and there's another person, Rodrigo Nyundamu, who's in opposition. So there's actually two of us here in Ra and now they can rely on us, you know, to be their voices and to represent them in Parliament.
Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama banned the use of native languages in Parliament in an attempt to make Parliament more inclusive. But over the last 4 years, many MPs and Fijian citizens have been pushing for change. And that came when the new coalition government took power late last year. Ms. Mbainivalu used the opportunity to speak in Fijian in her maiden speech. She said speaking in the native languages allows MPs to speak directly to their constituencies.
Some of us, we relate better to our voters, to our people, when we speak to them in our dialect. Rather than speaking in English, some of them don't quite understand the meaning of what we are trying to portray or to deliver to them. So when we speak in our dialect, it gives it a lot of meaning and there's a lot of emphasis and there's also a lot of depth, you know, in the fact that we are actually speaking in our dialect to our people, and it means a lot to them as well.
Professor Biman Prasad is a deputy prime minister in the new government. In his first speech as a government MP, he spoke in Hindustani, the language of his ancestors, who were brought to Fiji by the colonial government 144 years ago.
For Fiji, it's a very good natural advantage to speak Hindi, promote Hindi, and the fact that we have now decided that you can speak Hindi in Parliament gives it a better profile, and it will help the preservation, teaching and dissemination of Hindi as a language amongst the broader community.
Dr. Paul Garrity is considered the authority in the study of the Fijian indigenous language. A graduate of Cambridge University in England, he completed a dissertation on the history of the Fijian languages while completing his PhD at the University of Hawaii. He's worried about the future of the Fijian language and wants it used as a serious medium of instruction.
It's only recently that we had this introduction of the law saying that everybody should speak in English. Right. Now, indeed, I think people should be allowed to speak their own languages in Parliament, and as it is with parliaments all over the world. But the problem with that is we don't have any professional interpreters in Fiji. They just don't exist. So there's going to be a problem with the quality of translation and interpretation to the extent that they are needed.
Dr. Garrity believes the Fijian language has not been preserved since the 1930s. If it is used at an official level, he says this could drive formal work in the use and preservation of formal vernacular.
So why do we require people to be representatives of the people to be able to speak English? Now, this is, to me, it's undemocratic, right? People don't speak English, and people speak Fijian, lots of, as you say, dialects of Fijian. People speak Fiji Hindi. Those are the two main languages, right? And at the moment, if you wish to represent your people in Parliament, you have to be an English speaker. This is totally unfair, in my opinion. So it doesn't happen anywhere else in the world, as far as I know. It means that a lot of people, the vast majority of people in Fiji, feel disenfranchised linguistically.
For parliamentarian Alitia Mbainivalu, she hopes her use of the dialect will have an impact on the people of Ra.
In future, yes, I'd love to speak in Itauke language or in my dialect. It depends on the subject that is on discussion. If it warrants me to speak in my dialect, I will. If I know that it will make a change or an impact on the audience, on my audience, and I will definitely speak in my dialect or in Itauke language.
Alitia Mbainivalu, a Fiji MP, ending that report from Letha Mavona in Suva. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Review for this week. Thank you for listening, and do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from around the Pacific.